This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Writing about Ireland is never easy, says Martin Dillon. He's a journalist from Northern Ireland who's written a trilogy of books on the conflict that were each number one bestsellers there. Now those books have been published in paperback in the U.S. God and the Gun is about the church and Irish terrorism. The Shankill Butchers profiles a gang of murderers. The Dirty War uncovers the strategies and self-justifications of terrorists and informers on both sides of the conflict in Northern Ireland. Conor Cruz O'Brien, who wrote the introductions for two of the books, has described Dillon as the greatest living authority on Irish terrorism. I asked Martin Dillon how successful he thinks former terrorists have been in adjusting to the peace process in Northern Ireland.
I think it's very difficult to know, and I think it's going to take a long time to make a firm judgment about that. There have been a lot of prisoner releases, which is part of the, I suppose, the process of trying to normalize the society. Some of those people worry me, because some of them, in many ways, were very dysfunctional individuals. Is it a situation in conflict? I think society is temporarily abnormal. And you find that people who in a normal society would be ostracized, in a society in conflict, they're regarded possibly as heroes within their own community because of that cult of the gunman. And in a time when conflict has ended, those people still have that tag of being, you know, one of their community's heroes. And a lot of them are not going to know how to behave. And I think one of the things that probably is forgotten is that there's been a very high level of criminality, which has been obscured by coverage of bombings and shootings. And I think that's going to continue as well. And I think it's going to take a long time for this society to really, I suppose, find its way, and particularly for guys who've been involved in some of the grisly, some of the gruesome stuff.
I've been reading that punishment beatings are on the rise. Punishment beatings are when leaders of a paramilitary discipline their own people by beating them. Tell us more about the punishment beatings and why you think they're on the rise now.
I think part of the reason for that, there's always been a level of violence of that kind where the paramilitaries regarded themselves as the policing, the policemen in their own community. And because, particularly, let's say, within the Catholic nationalist community, there is no acceptance, really, of the royalist or constabulary, the IRA, even in a peace process, will still regard itself as the policing function in its own community. So guys are involved in drug dealing. They'll be taken out, beaten with baseball bats, or shot through the back of the kneecaps or through the front of the kneecaps. And the same also within Protestant working class areas as well. And I don't think this is going to stop, but it does highlight one very important thing. How do you move the society towards an acceptance of proper policing? I don't know how they're going to do that, decommissioning or no decommissioning. I think in the future, policing is going to be one of the most difficult things to resolve.
And you're saying that the police were distrusted in Catholic neighborhoods because the police force was a predominantly Protestant force.
And remains so. I mean, some of the policemen have said to me in the past, look, we're really worried because if there are radical changes to the police forces constituted, we're going to find paramilitaries running community police forces. I don't know what's going to happen. I mean, I really feel for Chris Patton. Here's a man who goes to Hong Kong to take on that issue, and God help him, someone gives him the job in Northern Ireland of looking at the whole issue of policing. Policing has been central to a lot of things because throughout the history of the Northern Ireland state, the police force, in one stage, its paramilitary wing, the B Specials, really were the driving force to maintain, I suppose, Protestant ascendancy within and Protestant domination within the state. The police have been involved also in a lot of very dubious episodes over the years. There's been collusion between the police and Protestant paramilitaries. And things are only beginning to surface now about the kind of dirty war that has been fought. And the chief constable at the moment in Northern Ireland, and for some time, has refused, from a Catholic point of view, to accept that it isn't such a glorious history. But again, to change it fundamentally, I don't know how they're going to achieve it. I really personally, as someone who's written a lot about it, I don't know.
One of your three books that has just been published in the United States is called God and Gun, The Church and Irish Terrorism. And you write in the introduction to that book that you discovered it was easier to get terrorists to talk than to get priests and ministers to talk. Why was it
so amazing, isn't it?
Why was it so difficult to get priests and ministers to talk with you?
I'll tell you, one of the things I discovered was that the churches had more control over their members than the paramilitary groupings.
You mean the church hierarchy?
Yeah. I mean, priests and ministers were frightened. They would talk to you about dogma. And also there's this sense that they were religious, therefore they couldn't in any way apply religion to the conflict itself. It was easy to get up and express indignation, but they never really got down there and said to people, stop this. I remember one priest telling me, he arrived in West Belfast, in the Falls area, which was the heart of sort of the IRA, and he said it was like walking on the moon. No one had told him. He'd just come out of the seminary. He'd just gone into the priesthood. He didn't understand what was going on. How was he going to cope with this? What would he do if someone walked into the confessional and said, by the way, tomorrow we're going to kill a politician? And he faced this sort of problem. And his fellow priests, their attitude was, you know, close the curtains. And they used a sort of sexual term, what he should do with himself. Have a brandy and forget about what's out there. In other words, be a priest in the pulpit, serve communion, say mass, but whatever you do, don't bring that in here. And that was a view within the church itself. Also, I think the churches felt that because of the tribal situation, that they had to almost support their own community, even though that community at times was exhibiting a prejudice towards either Protestants or Catholics or whatever. In other words, in a divided society, the churches felt that they had to defend the status quo in their own communities. And that was very, I think, very negative.
Some of the priests you spoke to were up against really difficult ethical dilemmas, you know.
Yeah.
For example, maybe you could tell the story of one priest who was called in to give somebody their final confession before this person was murdered by the IRA as punishment.
Frightening. It was, you know, when I met these priests, they were, one was older than the other, they were traumatized by it. Because I think they felt in a way that here they'd been asked to go along to give the last rites. They were dealing with men who were about to be
executed,
about to be murdered. And the priest couldn't help them. I remember another priest saying to me, had it been me, they'd have had to kill me. But he could say that at a distance. The priest who faced it really, I suppose, said to themselves, well, if we didn't do it, that person would not have been able to have a last confession. But it's the harrowing nature of what they looked at. These were men who had been badly beaten before they were about to be shot. And the priest couldn't change their fate. I mean, one of them said he felt that in a way that God was almost in the room with them. And the attitude of the terrorists who were about to kill these men was, you do your business, Father, and we'll do ours, and I get lost. And they were quite prepared, really, to kill the priest.
One of the things that the priests were up against was if they were called to give last rites to somebody before the person was executed, then the priest would probably know who some of the executors were.
Yeah.
And that's another ethical dilemma. Do they inform or not?
What do you do? If you're a priest, I think talking to priests who find themselves in that kind of predicament, their attitude was, you know, we are not there to be policemen. We're not there to be detectives. If we, on just one occasion, go out and identify the people who are committing this murder, then anyone who's ever held in the future and who's about to be executed will never have a last confession, and it will put all other priests at risk. Now, some people might say that, you know, is not a position which is morally justifiable. But in a situation in conflict, very strange decisions are taken. And one of the things that shocked me was that the Irish Catholic hierarchy never sat down. They refused to talk to me about this. They refused to talk to me about it. They didn't even talk to their own priests about it. One of the priests I spoke to, an IRA man, walked into the confessional and said to him, I've just been at a meeting and we are planning the assassination of a politician. And this particular priest argued with the guy for several hours until the penitent agreed to let the priest phone the authorities and the assassination was aborted. But how many others didn't do that? The IRA at one stage, interestingly enough, told its members that if they went to confession, they didn't have to confess to killing British soldiers. So therefore, they never found themselves in confrontation with the church, so that a priest would not have to be in a position to say, I'm denying you absolution, or move towards the excommunication thesis. So IRA men went in and they would say, Father, okay, you know, I've been sleeping with someone else's wife or whatever, but killing was not mentioned.
You've interviewed many of the terrorist paramilitary people over the years. How did you make contact with them?
I suppose really because I'd never supported any of the combatants or protagonists, it was easier for me to make approaches sometimes through third parties. And they knew my writing, they knew the programs that I'd made, both in radio and television. I think they felt that they had a degree of trust in me that I wouldn't misrepresent what they were about. I think that was very helpful in many ways.
Did any of them make deals with you before you spoke with them about what their ground rules were?
Yeah, they told me. I remember being hooded and put in the boot of a car. It's a very strange experience because it made me think, what was it like for people who were about to be killed who were hooded? And I was taken to a house and was there for 2 days. There was an IRA intelligence chief who said to me at one stage, we are saying things to you to help you understand what we are about, but if you ever publish them, we'll kill you. He said, are you listening to me? And I said, yeah, I understand perfectly what you're saying to me. Other terrorists I met were of a different kind of character. A man called John Bingham abducted me once and put a gun in my mouth, and Cole Steele has a strange way of erasing any capacity for thought. And this is so bizarre, you're not going to believe this. A couple of days later, he phoned me, and he said, Martin, I'm really sorry about that. I was just very angry about what you'd written in relation to some of my friends. He said, I'd like to make it up to you. Would you come up to my house and have a drink? I don't know whether writing gets to you when you're writing about conflict after a while, but I thought it was such a weird request that I went to his house, and it was the house just with a wooden front door. But I noticed as I went in that there was a steel door behind it. He was frightened of being assassinated by the IRA. And he took out a bottle of whiskey and said, I only drink Scotch. I don't drink Irish. You know, typical of a sort of a loyalist who hated everything Irish. We sat down. At one stage, he reached under a cushion on the couch and he took out a plastic bag. And from it, he withdrew a gun. And there was still oil residue in the barrel. I remember looking down that barrel and thinking, you know, I wonder whose eyes found that barrel before mine. And I kept trying to excuse myself to get out. I was very frightened. And he said to me, I just want to tell you, I couldn't hurt a pigeon. I knew this man was a murderer. But I didn't want to express any indignation. I was vulnerable enough in his presence. And he said, you know, I've got racing pigeons at the back of my house. Would you like to see them? And I said, look, John, I really have to go. I have to go. And I remember when I was walking out of the house, he put his hand on my shoulder. His voice was very low and menacing. And he said, I just want to tell you something, Martin. He said, if you ever write anything about me again, I'm going to effing kill you, because one thing is, you're not a pigeon. You know that, and I remember thinking later, what is it about some of these people? And he was assassinated about a month later. He forgot to close the steel door at the back of his front wooden door. It's that kind of thing. Sometimes it stays in your memory. You know, it gives you bad nightmares.
My guest is journalist Martin Dillon. His trilogy of books about Northern Ireland has just been published in the U.S. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Martin Dillon. He's a journalist from Northern Ireland who has been living in New York for the past few years. Three of his books, which have been bestsellers in Ireland, have just been published in the United States. One of the big issues now in the peace process in Northern Ireland is the issue of decommissioning. In other words, how soon should the IRA hand over its weapons? And I think it officially doesn't have to happen until May of the year 2000. But there's a lot of pressure on the IRA to do it now as a kind of indication of their goodwill with the peace process. What's your reading of the decommissioning? Sometimes it seems like the whole process is going to fall apart on this one issue.
I think the British government should never really have hung itself on this issue. Because by doing so, the consequence was the unionists also did the same thing. I think conflict resolution, decommissioning comes at the end. This is about changing people's perspectives, about changing the way in which they would like to address the future, about finding common ground, about saying we want to develop a structure, a framework, a different kind of tapestry where guns will not be required. Therefore, decommissioning happens almost inevitably. But to say to the IRA, let's say I'm a member of the IRA, the British government says to me, right, okay, we want you to hand over your weapons. You're going to say, I'm going to trust you after hundreds of years of conflict, after the past 30 years. I'm actually going to trust you. This will come at the end. The British government then says to me as a member of the IRA, let's say, well, why don't you give us some weapons? The IRA position, very simply, is if we hand over 200 AKs and 300 automatic pistols, people are going to say, is that all they're handing over? Or if they've got that, what must they have lying on the ground? And then decommissioning becomes an even more protracted issue. Personally, I think it's very worrying because the IRA position, and Gerry Adams has been told this time and time again, and he knows it very well, that the IRA will not decommission until there's a solution in place. Because the IRA is worried about its own ranks. It's worried about a split within its ranks. It's worried about people saying, by the way, after all of this, you've sold us out. And the history of Irish republicanism is one where Irish republicans don't mind killing their own leaders if they think that there's been a sellout, they've betrayed the cause. So the IRA itself, with Adams, McGuinness up front for Sinn Féin and the army, are walking a very thin line as well. Because they've got people in the wings watching them. Trimble, as head of the union, has got Paisley and others in the wings saying, you've got to get decommissioning or else you're betraying the unionist position, you're betraying the orthodoxy. So decommissioning, I think the British government should get off this hook if they can, but perhaps it's too late. I really don't know. It's a worrying factor.
You've been living in New York. Is it dangerous for you to be in Northern Ireland?
Yes. And I think my parents still live there, and my father has never really, over the past couple of years, wanted me to stay with him. And I can understand that. He doesn't want to be put at risk if something's going to happen to me. When I came to New York in January a year ago, I didn't say anything to anyone, but after God and the Gun was published, Billy Wright, who was one of the more extreme Protestant paramilitary leaders, was assassinated in prison. And some of his henchmen felt that I had, savaged him in God and the Gun. And they were prepared to kill me. And so I was warned. And one of the warnings, strangely enough, came from a Protestant paramilitary leader who phoned me up and said, look, Martin, I just want to tell you that there are certain people in our community. He said, I don't approve of it, but I can't stop them either. And they're interested in killing you. And one or two people in the security business said to me, this is not a very healthy place for you. And I said, well, I'm going to New York to promote a book. And they said, well, perhaps you should stay there. So, you know, it is. It's not a place where I feel safe. Some journalists from home have spoken to me recently, said to me, you know, don't come back.
Did people always want to know whether you were Protestant or Catholic?
Yeah. I grew up under the shadow of St. Peter's Spires in West Belfast. I'd even forgotten, I didn't know. Gerry Adams reminded me about 2 years ago that I was in his class at school.
You were in his class?
Yeah, we were taught by the Christian Brothers, the stormtroopers of the Irish Catholic Church, and brutalized by them, I think, at the same time. And Gerry took me into the school. I was interviewing him for a book, and he took me into the school, the primary school, where we were between the ages of 5 and 11, and to show me photographs. And suddenly it was a time for the Angelus. It was 12 o'clock. I'd forgotten my prayers. And Gerry, it was like flesh dwelt amongst us. The kids, their eyes opened wide. Here they had a real hero. When I was growing up, we always had dead heroes, whereas here was a live one. And it struck me in a strange kind of way that Adams went one way and I went the other. Yeah, I was writing about it and he was involved in it. And then I left to go to school in England, which probably wasn't a bad thing in many ways. It detached me somewhat from the kind of conditioning which is a part of everyone's life in Ireland. I think we all have our fingerprints on it, even if it's through an expression of indignation about our own community rather than the other one. But also there are a lot of very peculiar things about people's lives. I discovered later in my life that my great-grandfather was called William Carson. He was a Protestant. The word name Carson's a very prominent Protestant name, but no one ever told me. So when I was growing up, I had these elderly aunts called Bridget and Sarah Carson. Nobody told me, you know, their dad had been, you know, a Protestant from Temple Patrick. You know, it's that kind of layered thing, interwoven tapestry, which is there.
Well, Martin Dillon, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Martin Dillon's trilogy about Northern Ireland has just been published in the U.S. The books are God and the Gun, The Shankill Butchers, and The Dirty War. I'm Cherie Gross, and this is Fresh Air.